Joining me now is Dr. David Harvey, retired judge and also a regular contributor on the Fourth Estate here with RCR, and a special interest in media and internet, which is why I have you along today. David, hello, welcome along to RCR 360.
Hi, thank you, Marie, and thanks for the invitation. Happy to contribute what I can.
Yeah, well, look, we're looking at trust and the decline in trust in media. Now, it's not just here, it's a Western phenomenon. Can you pinpoint any single event, or is this a combination of issues that is causing this decline in trust, do you think?
I think in many respects, it's a combination of issues that coalesced with a single event. So what you've had has been the sort of polarization, if you like, of societal groups, so that you've got ideologies developing, you've got I'm right, you're wrong, and I'm never going to listen to you, and anything that you say is rubbish type of stuff. And that all started to develop around about the mid-2010s, 2015, 2016, reached its sort of high point with the first Trump victory. Then you had COVID. And that, to me, was where all of the strands came together, where there might have been a sort of disparate lack of trust or confidence in the media. COVID sort of focused it, because states wanted to get a message across, and in that respect, they wanted to control the messaging system. And in this country particularly, surprise, surprise, we had a prime minister whose degree was in what?
Communication.
And so the messaging became very, 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 very clear, very, very focused. And the media were brought on board, disparaged anybody who had a contrary point of view. Then, of course, you've got the Public Interest Journalism Fund, which was an absolute disaster in terms of the way that it was sold. And that only helped to enhance what everybody thought. Well, we've been worried about the media, but hey, look, they're taking this government money and they're not letting anybody else have a say or anything like that. So, yeah, I think COVID was what brought it all together. And it's continued to go downhill from there, coupled with the fact that there has been a rise in alternative media, for example, RCR and the other one. What are they called? The platform. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, come on.
yeah, the platform. And then, of course, you've got things like Substack, which I use extensively, as you know, and various other outlets, numerous outlets where people can get the information that they want to get and which they rely on, or alternatively, which they trust. So it isn't as though there's a sort of lack of trust in information systems. It's a lack of trust in some of the ways in which it's been delivered, and that in particular is mainstream media.
And those surveys have been, AUT have done a lot of work in the space for a
yes,
number of years.
Wonderful
and they,
work.
Yeah, and in April of 24, they released their Trust in Media survey. It had dropped by 9 points down to 33% after 42% the year previous.
Yep.
And then just in recent days, there has been a new Ipsos poll that has come out. Slightly different question, but it's asked a very large sample size across 8 city councils, and there is now only a 27% trust in media.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look like it's abating. So what is continuing the slide in this country now that it's a long hangover from COVID, David? What else is going on, do you think?
It is. But I think what you've got to, you see, believe it or not, I'm one of the few consumers in this country of mainstream media left. Only because you've got to know what's going on. Mm. So I get the Herald delivered to my letterbox, you know, the print version, which is pretty much a repeat of, rinse and repeat of what they've got online. I regularly consult the online version. I watch TVNZ1 News at 6 o'clock, appointment viewing, still there, but only because it's necessary to see what's going on, not only as far as the way in which the news is being broadcast or put out there, but also in seeing the way that it's being put out there. Now, TVNZ One News, for example, is so superficial, it's ridiculous. You know, here's the story, and if you want to know anything more, go to TVNZ Plus. You'll be able to see the full trip. Well, and if you go to TVNZ Plus and follow their, you know, idiot's guide to smart TVs that they always put up there, you get exactly the same story with a few extra frills. So it's superficial, and that's the problem. There's no in depth. You look at the only in-depth program that's on television, that's Q&A, which is at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning when I'm reading, and I don't watch it at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning. If I think that there's anything interesting on Q&A, I'll get it on demand. But that comes through as an exercise often in gotcha journalism. It isn't a here's the situation, I'm going to ask the question, and then I'm going to shut up while you answer it. And then when you've finished answering it, I'm going to talk to you about the answers that you've given. Now, Guy on Espana, for example, is reasonably good at this. Jack Tame is young and enthusiastic and has a tendency to jump in all the time. But what these characters need to do, all journos need to do, is go to cross-examination school. Cross-examination is the way in which you get the truth. We know that in the law. But journos obviously haven't got the memo.
I have a very clear image of you now, David, yelling at the television, begging them to ask the obvious question.
Oh, that, is, yeah. Oh, for sure.
You're amongst friends, David. You're very much amongst friends. So then the public, the general watching and listening and reading public, as you said, there's a superficiality there. Do you think legacy media in this country have actually forgotten who their audience is, or they've actually treated their audience as if they're stupid? They don't actually warrant, want, or deserve a quality of media that they themselves don't want to deliver anymore?
The latter. They treat the audience like their children. And they make a whole lot of assumptions. I mean, in some respects, probably the education system is to blame because their critical thinking isn't taught. But I think they treat their audience as stupid, and that probably accounts for a lot of the superficiality. I mean, you read any of the stories in the Herald, and particularly in the Print Herald, you know, they are designed for people with the attention span of a gnat. It's just, you know, there's just nothing to it. And, you know, you want to drill down. So what happens if I find a story that's particularly interesting? I go online and drill down, first stop Google, find out if there are any other sources of information and so on and so forth. And if there are, follow those three, see where they go. As I always say when I'm doing academic writing, don't worry so much about the content of the paper, look at the footnotes, because that'll set you on a trail that can be very, very interesting indeed about the subject that you're investigating.
And it's also to being the fertilizer that independent media such as ourselves has used to propagate and flourish.
Yeah.
So the government being the government, when they obviously are aware in this trust in media, and actually referring back to this Ipsos poll, if I may, 27% trust the media, 48 mistrust, so pretty much half of New Zealanders do not trust the media, the police at 68%, scientists at 62%, public education at 50%, I thought that was quite high, health system at 47%, the justice system at 44%, David, are you surprised by that number?
The justice system at 44%. No, I'm not, but not because it doesn't do what it ought to do, because it does. The main complaint about the justice system is one that Hamlet had back in 1599, when he complained in the To Be or Not to Be soliloquy about the law's delays. And it's the delays that's the problem. I mean, you know, you read in the paper, so-and-so has been charged with a horrendous crime, murder or something like that, and they're not going to get a trial until mid-2026. Oh, really? You know, when I started practice, you know, you'd have a trial for murder. You know, Arthur Allen Thomas's trial for murder happened within months of his being charged. You know, the system has become bogged down, and I think that is one of the major problems about lack of trust. It's a worry. But when you talk about trust, and particularly as far as media are concerned, which are deliverers of information. I mean, the justice system is deliverers of results. Media are deliverers of information. So when can you trust that information? As you know, as a lawyer and as a former judge, I would say, can I rely on that evidence in considering what decision I'm going to make? Is that evidence reliable? If it isn't reliable, then, you know, a particular outcome is not going to happen, or a particular outcome is going to happen, depending on which side you are. So it's not only trust, it's also reliability, because, you know, we need news to inform us about what's going on in the world around us so that we can make decisions about what we're going to do with our lives. And we need reliable information for that. And that's a collateral, you know, issue along with trust.
So, and the last two on this, of course, local government, central government, both had only 28% of media at 27% trust. They're all very happy bedfellows. And one of the things that they have tried to do, the government, is look at a series of regulation, particularly now with the sprouting up of so many independent media operators. As you mentioned before, there's likes of us in the internet space, Substack, various blogs. Cam Slater has been working in the space now for decades very successfully, but he's also seen the inside, a fair bit of time in the inside of a courtroom as well.
I was the judge.
So when we now look at overreach, we see, well, I'm calling it overreach. That's a bit of an assumption on my part, but certainly regulation. There is a new document out, and it is from the Ministry of Culture and Heritage, and it's called A Proposal on Media Reform. And I talked about it a little bit on Media Matters last week. And there are five sort of steps in there. You have written about it in your Substack. And the five steps are ensuring accessibility of local media platforms, increasing investment into discoverability of local content, increasing captioning and audio description, modernising professional media regulation, streamlining Crown content funders. Now, if you're somebody who just skims past this and doesn't actually think too deeply about any of it, I mean, you've got fluff, fluff, fluff. Hello, fluff. The hello, modernising professional media regulation. What on earth is professional media, David?
Well, to put it briefly, the document itself discloses that and says this needs further work. They haven't actually defined the target of what it is they are after. So are they after broadcast media? Do they want to change the specific exceptions to broadcast media that are contained in the Broadcasting Act, which mean that online and on-demand content isn't covered? Do they want to extend it to online and on-demand content? Do they want to regulate everything that's going across the internet, all forms of communication? What they don't realize in all of this is that if they were to extend it that broadly, if they were to make professional media basically anybody who delivered information across the internet, that would mean that people like me writing for Substack could be subject to some form of control or regulatory disciplinary body. Okay, so that means that in terms of the law, I would become a journalist. I would have the right to sit in court and take notes as a journalist. I would have the right, if the police or the authorities or the GCSB or somebody like that came calling, to say, you can't ask me for that information. I'm protected by the provisions of Section 68 of the Evidence Act, which protects journalist sources. So have they thought this through?
Mm.
No.
Well, it's
That's just one thing, Murray. That sort of leapt out at me. And, you know, I'm a bear of very little brain. You know, to me, that was so bleeding obvious that it surprises me that they missed it. But there are a whole lot of other issues surrounding this that are important.
Well, it just, look, I'm only a layperson, David, but I read through it and it just felt rushed and sloppy.
Oh, it is.
To be fair?
It is. It is rushed and sloppy, and it requires a lot more work. And one of the things that they don't really address is, what are we going to do with the Broadcasting Standards Authority? Because the Broadcasting Standards Authority covers broadcast, you know, TV and radio spectrum. And that's fair enough, because since the 1920s, the state has had various levels of interest in broadcast media. I mean, the state basically ran broadcast media for decades, from the 1920s until around about the 1980s, when things began to loosen up. So one of the things that the state felt was, well, if we're going to exercise this level of control over media, over broadcast media, then we've got to have some kind of regulatory body that sets standards for what the public can expect to receive. And so the Broadcasting Standards Authority was set up. Now, the thing is that, you know, with the advent of the internet and the advent of online systems and so on and so forth, audience numbers have migrated to all sorts of different platforms. You know, broadcast, linear broadcast and legacy media is dying. You know, I mean, the idea of, you know, getting your television signal in the old-fashioned way with an aerial on the roof is not going to be with us for very much longer. So that whole sort of broadcasting model is going completely. What is the obvious answer to that? Do we need a Broadcasting Standards Authority? And if broadcasting is dying and there's a whole lot of other stuff coming through, the answer to that must be no. Second question, in that case, does the state continue to have an interest in broadcast quality and so on and so forth, or media quality? Answer to that, no, it doesn't. Not because the state actually has no ownership interest or anything like that. The only interest that they might have would be in terms of public safety or you know, that very wide term, public interest. But let's put that to one side. Who are the best people to regulate or to set standards for the delivery of content? The answer to that is self-regulation, the providers themselves. Why do I say that? Because the news media does it. The news media has the New Zealand Media Standards Council. And they do a very, very good job within the news media space. And they have quite a wide jurisdiction. And that's voluntary. That is voluntary. And that sort of came from the Press Council, which was set up in 1972 when the then Labor government was going to set up a press council, a state press council, to regulate. And the press said, we don't want the state involved. And very wisely and sensibly too. And hey, who was doing it? A Labor government, surprise, surprise. But the same sort of situation now pertains. Who should be doing this? It should be self-regulation. It should be voluntary. The state has no business in this area. The only area that it has a business in is in censorship. And that's covered by the Films, Videos and Publications Classification Act. Simple.
Well, and of course, that censorship, though, became very subtle and less subtle across COVID. And I think that brings mm-hmm. that full circle in terms of trust. Like you brought up the point before that they hadn't considered that if they were to bring everybody under this umbrella, in terms of reform, that anybody like myself, yourself, anyone that had a Substack could then become an accredited member of the press and therefore have all of those protections. But yep. then you have Jacinda Ardern, who famously said to somebody who was a citizen journalist, I only answer questions from accredited media. Thank you very much. Yeah. So, you know, all of a sudden they do leave themselves wide open to the questions that those who are close to them have seemed to have lost an appetite to ask.
Yeah. But it's, yeah, the issue of qualification as an accredited journalist, as far as the law is concerned, is a very narrow one. There are a whole lot of other issues about the media reform process that need to be asked and answered. And one of them is, who are we going to regulate? If there is to be a regulatory body, even if it is to be a self-regulatory body, who is it going to cover? Well, no, perhaps it should be targeting New Zealand providers that are domiciled and do business in New Zealand. And, you know, the answer would be, well, what about Netflix and all of that? Well, you know, what about Netflix? They're an offshore provider. They're not under our jurisdiction. So put that to one side. You only want to regulate people that you can regulate. And you know, offshore jurisdiction, believe me, is a very, very complex subject. So it should be news. What sort of content should they be delivering? Well, point one, immediately news media should be excluded because they're already under the jurisdiction of the News Media Standards Council. So they're taken care of. So that leaves a very narrow sort of area where there a regulatory body, a voluntary regulatory body, could be formed, and it could be, you know, New Zealand streaming services and people like that. So all of a sudden you get a very narrow focus of what would be professional media.
Mm. It has a feeling of make work about it from the minister, doesn't
it? Oh, yeah. I think Goldsmith is saying, I got to be doing something.
You say in the end of your piece here, after you highlight the different functions, moving down proposed functions of the regulator in a modernised broadcasting standards regime, there is a fondness for these regulators now, David, which I do find rather tedious. Now, at the end of this, you say these functions aim to ensure positive system-level outcomes, their words, not yours, yep. uphold industry and community standards and support a fair and consistent regulatory environment for all professional media in New Zealand. So are they implying that digital creators and writers and independent journalists or independent citizen journalists do not?
Well, there's that assumption, isn't there? But, you know, that assumption arises from, you know, they're not regulated. We're not telling them what to do. Therefore, they can't be coming up to the standards that we would require, whatever they might be. So, yeah, I mean, it's the hunger for regulation. I mean, I as you know, I taught internet law for 18 or 19 years at Auckland Law School. And over that time, you know, I confronted all sorts of efforts that were made to regulate the internet, to regulate the internet to start with, that is the backbone itself, and to regulate content delivery. And only a few countries have actually done it successfully. And the most successful, well, it isn't absolutely perfect, is the People's Republic of China. And even there, you can get around the Great Firewall of China. But they have a huge regulatory and censorship system. And the question is, do you want to go down that track? And the answer in a liberal democracy is, of course not. But yeah, these efforts that have been made to try and regulate the internet, you know, they come from governments that you know, have to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is particularly interesting given, I'll just tell you a little story by the side. We had some American friends across last week. And one of the subjects that we specifically avoided was the president. But believe it or not, the president actually came up in a discussion where one of our guests said, there's one thing that we'll say about Trump, at least he does something. and he's getting things done. And I thought, yep. And he could provide a very, very good lesson for the current outfit down in Wellington, who doesn't seem to be doing anything. I mean, they're rather like Labour Light in that regard. Labour sort of promised big and delivered zero, and the present government is promising big and delivering a little, but not a lot. I know that it takes time to, you know, turn an economy around, but by the same token, you know, these are people who want to be seen to be doing something. The raison d'etre, if you like, for a bureaucrat down in Wellington is to find work to do. Because once you've actually achieved an objective, you know, you could find yourself out on the street.
Mm. Because you go, well, this is just it. And we know that both within government and media, there are redundancies left, right, and centre.
Yep.
And so then that brings us to the next and final portion of your article. You say here, industry and regulator feedback. There is a broad agreement among industry bodies and regulators that modernising media regulation is necessary and overdue. So yep. Obviously that's been a very internal echo chamber based discussion, or is it just a matter of a few of the media lovies that are doing the tile run, having a bit of a moan and whinge to Paul Goldsmith as he comes past saying, when are you going to do something about this internet crowd?
Yeah, a little bit of that. The other thing about it is, for example, let's look at the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Because they're dealing solely with broadcast media, they're completely out of date. There are a whole lot of other media that are doing what broadcast media does using different channels. RCR is one of them. Should they be the subject of regulation? So, you know, from the point of view of a spectrum broadcaster or a spectrum radio broadcaster, you know, competing with an outfit like RCR is a little bit difficult because they've got certain standards that they've got to maintain under the Broadcasting Standards Authority, and RCR doesn't. I mean, the thing is, RCR has standards. It's got to have standards. Otherwise, you're not going to survive in the marketplace. It's as simple as that. But, you know, these people don't understand the nature of a free market where, you know, they feel you've got to regulate. You've got to have somebody wagging the finger and telling you what to do. So there is an element of people running off to the government, to Goldsmith and so on and so forth, and saying, do something, we need something to be done. But by the same token, there seems to be an unwillingness to actually meet the competition out where it matters, which is in the marketplace. Come on, get with it.
Well, finally, I mean, the fourth estate, you mentioned before about a liberal democracy. I mean, that's what we're trying to preserve. Our first episode was on democracy. And in liberal democracies, the fourth estate used to be that check and balance against government.
Yep.
In a liberal democracy. And it was that voice for the people if they saw things going awry. Well, that's now no longer the case. No. So is independent media like Substack, like ourselves here at RCR, are we now the new fourth estate that's not only check and balancing the government and those in power, but also having to check and balance legacy media?
I had a comment from a former journo on my Substack this morning, saying, you know, where's Warwick Roger? Where's Robin Langwell and the commentators of old? Well, you know, the answer to that is pretty much, except for a few journals like The Listener and North and South and so on and so forth, they're not there. So the mantle falls on the shoulders of citizen journalists, of which I classify myself as one. I have a fortnightly column and The Listener as well, so I'm under the Media Council's eye, Sauron's eye of the Media Council, chaired by my very good friend and former judge Rainer Asher. But so it's going the way of citizen journalists, and we are the ones who are going to have to hold government to account.
Yeah, I'm going to sneak one question in there because you brought him up earlier with Donald Trump. What effect do you think the Trump effect will have in terms of the public's general trust in media? Because according to that Ipsos survey, there's a quarter of Kiwis who are neutral, fairly neutral in terms of media. They're the ones that will swing either way. Will we see the Trump effect in this country allowing that self-censorship that has been dogging us for so long through the COVID and Ardern years, will that help free up the discussion and discourse of ideas and actually hopefully free up the bravery of media moving forward?
Well, yeah, okay. First, let's deal with the elephant in the room, which is Trump. The guy's crude. He has a limited vocabulary. He has the vocabulary maybe of a 15-year-old or something. This is very bad. Really? Okay. So why is it very bad? Well, it's just very, anybody knows it's very bad. Okay. Well, that's about the depth of the discussion that you're going to get. He doesn't know the meaning of polite conversation. You know, you get a long way if you're polite and you're reasonable and you let the other guy speak and you don't engage in personam attacks. And Trump is engaged in an personam attack on Volodymyr Zelensky online, referring to him as a former clown who has conned billions of dollars out of the United States. Well, that isn't going to help the discussion. That isn't going to make any progress in getting peace in the Ukraine. So, he is crude. So if people want to emulate that, well, fine, be my guest. It's just that I probably won't listen that carefully. Mm. But in dealing with the topics that people are afraid to deal with, he may be having an effect. And there's a person on Substack, Matua Kahurangi. And there's been an awful lot of mystery about who Matua Kahurangi is, because he says things about Maori that a lot of people have been thinking but wouldn't dare put their head above the parapet and say. And one journalist in the spin-off wrote a speculative article about who Matua Kahurangi was. The subtext of it being, Maori wouldn't say that sort of thing about themselves. who can this be? He must be a clone or a troll or something like that, you know, completely ignoring the fact that this guy actually has some valid things to say.
Mm.
And, you know, he's stuck his head up above the parapet. And as far as I'm concerned, whoever he is, be it Māori, Pākehā or whatever, good on him for doing that.
I actually spoke to Simon R. Anderson last week, and actually he came up in conversation. Simon is one of the few people that has actually spoken with him, so knows that he is a real person. And it's funny, you know, I saw that spin-off article as well, and the one thing I saw was this is written by somebody who's never gotten outside of the urban echo chamber of tribalist politic Māori. They've never spent any time in the provinces where I live. And yes, you've got these divisions there, but I'm growing up in a biracial family. There have been divisions within Māoridom for thousands of years, David. This is, you know, this is nothing new. That's really fascinating. And look, of course, you've mentioned Substack. You are on Substack at the Halfling's View. And I recommend to anybody, if you haven't read David's work, please do. It's, I have to admit, when I get the notification that you've published something, David, my little heart goes pitter-patter because I thoroughly enjoy it. So thank you very much, Marie. For the work.
I hope you'll enjoy tomorrow's.
I will. This has been David Harvey here with RCR 360. Thank you very much for joining me tonight, David.
Thanks, Marie. Pleasure to be here.